This is Triad Arts Weekend, where if you're not careful, you might just find something cool to do around here this weekend. I'm David Ford, and later on the show, Bethany Chafin will investigate the vocal, healing, and spiritual powers of poetry. But we begin with cold, moist, red Carolina clay. The words pottery and art installation rarely combine in the often reserved craft community of our state, but North Carolina native Daniel Johnston is not your average potter. Take his experiential installation 726 to 756 at Greenhill, a space for North Carolina art. In it, the viewer is invited to stroll through an 85-foot-long constructed tunnel of his 100 enormous, beautiful, handcrafted clay pots. You'll find photos on our website, wfdd.org, and the pots certainly have a powerful presence. With the exhibit, Daniel reveals something about the ongoing process of an artist at work in a craft medium. It's hard physical work, but he says he enjoys it, and he leaves no daylight between himself and the creative process. The result, pots that reflect both the culture and the times in which he lives.
I dropped out of school when I was 16, being fairly bored with high school, and I bought 10 acres of land. And so, of course, I had a mortgage, so I had to get a job. And I got a job at J.B. Cole's Pottery in Seagrove, making pots.
Was that pure coincidence?
It was. I wanted to be an artist. I also wanted to be a farmer. So making pots really fell into that perfect situation to where there's a lot of labor, the sort of labor of a farmer, but also the intellect of an artist. So it really fit me perfect.
Had you created a pot of your own before working for this organization?
Not really, no. That was really my first time making pots, was with J.B. Cole. And so I worked there for a couple of years. I made 60,000 pots in the first 2 years of my career, 30,000 pots a year. And I met Mark Hewitt, a British potter living in Pittsboro, North Carolina. He's part of a lineage that goes back to Michael Cardew and Bernard Leach. And so I took on a 4-year apprenticeship with him.
So what happened in the intervening years between, you know, you've got the land, you've got your job, and then in terms of education, I guess Mark Hewitt was a big part of that.
Yes, Mark Hewitt was a big part of the education. Also, I traveled to England and worked there with Clive Bowen, and that was a huge step for my education. I got to see a lot of architecture. I'm really interested in architecture, so to see that firsthand was pretty significant.
And going abroad, I think about the turn of the last century and composers going over to Europe to study with these great masters. I mean, is that sort of educational exchange common, or is that just something on a whim you went?
It's not common, but I'm still part of that very traditional apprenticeship program. So it's very much part of exactly what you're thinking of. The apprenticeship, the lineage that I'm part of, it dates all the way back for 100 years or so into where these British potters, Bernard Leach and Michael Cardew, were going to Japan and then coming back to England and creating potteries. So I'm part of that very classic apprenticeship tradition.
Do you remember the first time you were manipulating clay and what that feeling was like when before you started cranking out 30,000, 60,000 pots? did you know it was the right fit right away, or what was that like?
Yeah, the first pot was successful that I made. It was a nice little pitcher, a nice little creamer, I should say. And I just remember thinking what a fantastic thing to create something relatively powerful and beautiful in a moment. I found that very attractive.
I can get the beauty and the simplicity of something like that, and the power, but then the time element. Why is that significant?
You respond to the clay, and the clay responds to you. So there's a directness that happens that is unlike any other relationship that you have. All the other relationships that we have with things tend to be skewed by some personalities, or the directness with the clay is profoundly honest. The purity in that is very attractive. And it really grabs you and pulls you in. I think a lot of people feel that attraction to it.
I imagine, conversely, a lot of people could be intimidated by that.
They are. I think so. Yeah. And I think one of the most profound things that happened with learning to make pots is you really learn so much about yourself. Your personality comes out so clearly whenever you make pots. All of your weaknesses show up instantly, and then all of your strengths as well. You really have to work on yourself to be able to be a good potter. You have to be able to be a sound individual. And the clay reflects that whenever you touch it. If you have anything going on in your head, it shows up in the clay.
Wow. Is that something, I mean, I could see, for example, a surgeon has to have a steady hand, but in terms of clay and these internal workings and how it reflects itself in the art, could you give me an example of how something on your mind would transfer itself into the finished product in a way that maybe I wouldn't perceive, but certainly you would as the master?
Well, I'm not so sure you would see it so directly, and maybe I'll give you a broader example that's maybe not so glamorous, but just the fact that if you're at 16 years old, your attention span is pretty short. So when I started making pots, but to get good at making pots, you have to do it very consistently, and you have to spend a lot of time doing it. So to stand at the wheel and to throw pot after pot really taught me to have a great attention span, to increase my attention span. So that sort of very directly affected my mind. Otherwise, I may be on Adderall or Ritalin, but with the sort of strength of learning how to make pots and having to increase my attention span that way, then it's directly affected me. And if I was not able to stand there and do that and really put myself underneath that pressure, then I would never be able to become a good potter.
So you did these stints working for Clive Bowen in England and a lengthy stay as an apprentice to Sawian Silakom in Pombok.
Mm-hmm.
Did you speak Thai?
I do a little bit, but not enough to say I do.
Well, that was in Thailand, and you began to master a very different technique. Talk about the coil and throw technique and how that really is kind of the superior approach.
Yes, absolutely. So I decided to go to Thailand because they make beautiful large water jars there to collect rainwater and also large jars to ferment fish paste. So there's still a very thriving large pot culture there. And the large pot culture in the southern U.S. really has faded away until recent times. So I really wanted to go to a culture where they were producing large amounts of large pots and understand the technique and really understand the mentality in which the potters were making the pots. So I traveled to Pombok and to learn this beautiful technique that where you coil using very small coils and then throw the pots using compression of two pieces of wood.
Oh, interesting. You're talking about very thin coils versus maybe thicker, more bulky or clumsy coils you might see in other parts of the world?
One very popular way of creating large pots in the U.S. is to use a very long, large coil. That coil is wrapped all the way around the pot and then smashed together and then thrown, like a very conventionally add water and then turn the coil, to where these are very small coils in which I'm compressing, using both hands to compress the coil onto the pot, and I go around and around and around the pot until I get a segment built that's about 8 to 10 inches tall, and then I use two pieces of wood to compress that together with very little water, so it's not the sort of same way we throw pots with a lot of water and you're pushing on the pots with your fingers. I'm using two pieces of wood to compress that the walls.
Does that enable you to make it thinner or more delicate somehow? What's the advantage of that versus wetting it down?
The advantage of that is that the clay is never that wet, so you're just compressing it so that it holds its shape fairly strongly. Also, the speed in which this technique is a very efficient method of making large pots, and so the speed in which you can produce the pots. And it's also incredibly easy on your body.
Mm.
So the longevity of your career is very important, you know, as a potter, your sort of physical health.
What are some of the tolls that this sort of work can take on a person's body?
We should start with probably the knees, the back, the elbows, the shoulders.
You're sitting down a lot of time.
Standing up. We stand up to make pots. To make the large pots, I start sitting down, and then as the pot gets larger, I stand up. But we have to load these large pots into the kiln, and the pots can weigh as much as 200 pounds. So to load those into the kiln takes two people, and that's tough on your body. The kilns are huge. They're about the size of a school bus, so they'll hold up to 30 large jars and about 1,000 small pots. It can take a week to load the kiln. The firing lasts 4 days. It's all fired with wood. We fire with about 6 cords of pine, and the wood is burned 24 hours a day for 4 days. It takes 5 people to fire the kiln. And then digging the clay takes a lot of effort to refine the clay, to dig it and then refine it. So, it's very taxing on your body.
Yeah.
So you have to be very smart about the way you work.
Yeah, imagine.
So Matt Jones is a dear friend of mine. I met Matt years ago when we first started working at Mark's together. Matt is from Charleston. graduated from Earl College, came down from having an apprenticeship with Todd Piker down to Mark's to apprentice with Mark Hewitt as well, which is where we met, and we become really good friends. So he started giving me a little bit of a hard time when he first came in, and I just gave it back to him. And we've been, you know, we had our wheels set up beside each other, so we had to, you know, outdo each other every day. And the competition was great. You know, I would love to pick on him on air and say that, I did win after all. But but no, he's a fantastic guy. He did a beautiful, he's a beautiful writer, and he makes beautiful large pots and small pots with brushwork. And he's been doing some fairly aggressive drawing on his pots of late with some pretty interesting commentary on our society today. Yeah, he's a wonderful potter.
Yeah.
And a dear friend, and not only a friend, but an inspiration. I think we're inspiration to each other, drive each other.
I was thankful that he wrote about you and your work because as a colleague, he gets to the deeper meanings behind some of your work and the gestures you bring about in a way that I couldn't get as a non-potter myself. Mm-hmm. And with 726 through 756, you're, as Matt writes, kind of inviting us into your own mind so that we can experience with you a dreamscape. Tell me a little bit about your dreamscape.
Yes, so you essentially walk through about an 85-foot tunnel where all the pots will be lined up on a shelf. You're submerged into this tunnel, and you're walking around these large jars. It really does invite you into the workshop setting of a potter and the way it feels to be actually in the studio of an artist rather than in a gallery. So it allows the viewer to see the pots, oddly enough, not very well. They'll be speckled with light. There'll be a lot of distractions. So you get the overall sense of the production, of the craftsmanship, but you can't focus on a single object. I'm able to break your focus throughout the tunnel. You can't maintain your focus on a single pot. It becomes really important that you experience it as we experience walking through our studio or our workshop. You know, 85 feet is quite long to walk through. So I'm hoping by the time you get to the end of the tunnel, then you've sort of psychologically given in and just are just accepting what you see. You'll be right very close to the pots, which is also something that you don't really get to experience in a gallery. So I'm asking you to go inside of the artwork, not stay away from it.
I want to roll up my sleeves and dig into the clay a little bit with you,
okay,
if I may,
okay.
Daniel. Tell me a little bit about the material itself, where you find it, and how you, you know, tell good clay from bad, that sort of thing.
We're lucky enough to live in the Seagrove area where there's lots of clay. There's lots of different kinds of clay.
Where is that, by the way,
Seagrove? Seagrove is right in the middle part of the state, just below Ashboro. Yeah, we're about 15 minutes below Ashboro.
Okay.
There's beautiful clay there. To simplify it, there's lots of white clay and lots of red clay. And there's not really such thing as bad clay. It's sort of the way you use it. And it's what the part of digging local materials has a lot more to do with. You're making a conscious decision to refine it to the point that you want it to be refined. You are also making the conscious decision to try to look at the material and try to bring out the beauty in it and what it offers you. So I think a lot of times potters will try to force the clay to look a certain way. And the idea of using local materials really is a lot more about understanding that material and trying to maximize its power and its beauty.
One of the things, actually, Matt Jones was so good about, you know, kind of pointing out in his essay about you and your work was this ongoing, if not debate or conflict, discussion about art versus craft. And where do you stand on the issue with regard to this exhibit, maybe?
Well, this exhibit really is my answer to that question. I think it's a really great answer to the question, and I think it's something that you can't really put into words. There's some cultures to where the word artist doesn't even exist. So I think it's a sort of more of an emotion that you'll feel walking through the installation.
Well, Daniel Johnston, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
North Carolina potter Daniel Johnston. His experiential art installation 726 to 756 is part of the new exhibit at Greenhill, a space for North Carolina art in Greensboro. It's titled Daniel Johnston, Hiroshi Sueyoshi, Sculptural Clay. It opens May 1st and will remain on display through June 10th.
All pots are for sale. Porcelain and clay artist Hiroshi Sueyoshi teaches at the Cameron Art Museum's Panko Education Center as a master artist, and in 2006, he received the North Carolina Living Treasure Award. You'll find links to both men's work at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Boy, isn't it inspiring to hear someone talk about something to which they are so completely devoted? Well, we've got more of the same coming up with one of the hardest working women in the world of poetry. Cave Wall Press editor and award-winning poet Rhett Eisman-Trull will be reading at Scuppernong this weekend in Greensboro, but she'll be reading for you and associate producer Bethany Chafin just about 60 seconds from now after this short break from Triad Arts Weekend.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Stay tuned because later in the hour, it's Behind the Scenes with Mary Dalton. Today, she offers her insight on the documentary The Hunting Ground. The film is about sexual assault on college campuses through the eyes of victims, policymakers, and university personnel. But first, we delve into the written word. So, National Poetry Month might be over, but Rhett Eisman-Trull and her husband Jeff Trull still want to share great poetry with you. They're the editors of Cave Wall Press, a literary journal of poetry and art. The couple began the Greensboro-based press 7 years ago, and ever since then, they've published 1 to 2 poetry journals a year. Their latest issue, number 13, is now out. The issue features 20 poets, 36 poems, and 7 prints by artist Geraldine Thoreau. Rhett herself is an award-winning poet, and she recently joined me to talk about finding her poetic voice, how reading relates to writing, and the most recent issue of Cave Wall. How long have you been writing poetry?
I started writing really bad poetry when I was probably around 12 years old, and just kept at it, and really I went to Duke for undergrad, where I had some amazing poetry workshop teachers, Deborah Pope in particular, who were actually lucky enough to have 2 of her poems in this new issue of Cave Wall that's just out. And I wrote to her ever since we started Cave Wall and said, please, please send me poems. And she finally did. So, but she was when I was in college, she really kind of brought out my own voice as a poet. I really sort of realized the type of poetry I wanted to write and could write when I was in her class.
And what type of poetry is that?
Oh, that's a tough question. How do you define finding your voice? I think it's just something about my writing during those years stopped sounding like all the poetry I'd read growing up and was trying to write like. It just started sounding a little more like me and like my heart. Maybe a better way to say is I got out of its way. I think when I started writing poetry, and I think this is pretty common for most poets, you know what you want the poem to be. You're trying to make it a certain way. You're trying to turn it into something, and you're very focused on that. And then at some point, if you read enough and you keep writing enough, at some point you learn to listen for the poem more and what it wants to be, and you step out of its way a little bit. So I think that's when that started to happen for me. When I was in Deborah's class at Duke, I stopped trying to make the poem go a certain place and started just writing and letting some voice inside of me somewhere start speaking that wasn't exactly me. It was the voice of the poem, whichever particular poem I was writing at the time, the voice of that poem. I learned to listen for that and then let that take over and go where it wanted to. And it might not be where I thought it was going to go at the beginning. So I think that's what finding your voice is. It's more like finding the poem's voice, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. Okay. That's a really, I think, a beautiful idea, but it also sounds like a scary idea in order to sort of let go and let that poetic voice take over.
Right.
Do you have any practices that help you to kind of cultivate that voice or to just kind of relax into letting it take its course?
I think reading is the biggest practice for a poet. So the more well-read you are and reading all different types of poetry and all different types of writing, you know, I read everything from comic books to novels and all different types of poetry. When you're reading, that's what you're doing naturally. You are listening to the voice on that page in front of you. Whatever poem this is that you're reading, whatever story this is that you're reading, whoever the narrator or speaker is, you are sort of becoming that voice. You know, that voice is in your head and you're like living that voice for a little while. So I think that's the best practice. You know, if you're a poet or any kind of writer, the more you read, the more you get used to disappearing into the words, you know, and letting the work of art that you're reading sort of take over. And that's what you have to learn to do when you're writing. And it's hard to say you can just learn that skill. It's more like the more you read, for me anyway, it's reading. The more I read, the more I learn to listen to that other voice that's not under my control.
As an editor, you read a lot of submissions.
Oh,
and
yes.
How do you wear those two hats of writer and editor? Is it a conscious decision of today, this is the hat I'm wearing, or is it more fluid?
When I started out, so I'd say probably for the first 3 years or so of Cave Wall, it was a very conscious decision. It was, today I'm going to focus on Cave Wall. Today I'm going to read submissions. And I never mixed the two. I would never like read submissions in the morning and write my own poetry in the afternoon. It felt wrong to me for some reason. Now, no, I don't worry about that at all. Part of that is probably just getting more used to being able to go right into sort of my editor mode versus right into my Rhett the Poet mode. You know, I can go back and forth more easily because I've been doing it for a while. And also having a child, when you have a baby that you're taking care of, and that baby doesn't nap well, and, you know, that baby has needs all day long, you have to learn to let go of a lot of what I thought I needed to, you know, I need a certain amount of time to be able to sit down and really get into the right mindset to write a poem. I need a certain amount of time to do this Cave Wall stuff. No, it's more like I've learned to just grab the time when I can, and I can even almost do both things at once sometimes, I guess. You learn to multitask. I've learned to multitask a little better, taking care of a child.
Yeah, yeah. I bet. Well, let's talk about this new issue. It's your 13th issue. Yeah. And if you had to describe it as a whole, does this issue have a certain character?
They all sort of end up, I feel like each issue, even though I don't plan it that way, and when I'm reading poems and we're deciding on poems for it, it's not like we think, oh, we're getting poems a lot with this theme. Let's take stuff. We don't really do theme issues, but I mean, I think that if you just gather like 30 random poems and read them, you will find connecting things. And so that's one of the fun parts for me is once we've picked all the poems to sit down and read through it front to back and think, okay, what is really speaking to me in this issue? What are the poems saying to each other? And something always emerges. So this issue for me, as I read through it, there's a lot of music. A lot of singing and music and songs. One thing that kind of came to me as I was reading through it was sort of the timelessness that exists in poems. So I've always thought that writing and reading poetry is very much an act of being in the present moment, almost a meditation kind of thing. And this issue sort of taught me, it's more about being in every moment all at once. So I read them and I feel like I'm in this poem's past, and I'm also in this poem's future, and here's my past coming into play while I read this poem because it reminds me of this, and, you know, here's this present, and it's more about, like, you just lose all sense of time. So for me, this issue feels like this timeless song of what it means to sing and to chase music in our lives, like, whether that music is poetry or something on the radio or just the way we live becoming kind of a music. I think there's music everywhere, and for me anyway. I hear it everywhere in language, and issue 13 is an ode to music and an ode to timelessness and how the songs that we love and that make us who we are can carry us through all times in our lives.
How does, say, you know, a poetry reading differ from, say, someone reading from a novel? Like, if someone is in the audience at Scuppernong, what might they be able to expect? Or maybe what might they not be able to expect from Meg's reading?
I love that you ask me this question, because one thing I've noticed is a lot of people who don't read poetry regularly, even though they might be, you know, avid readers of other types of work, there's this fear of poetry, and then that translates into this fear of a poetry reading, like, oh, it's going to be over my head, I'm not going to get it, I just don't get poetry, I don't really know how to read it. And I just think, you know, what I say to people about reading poetry who aren't used to reading poetry and have that fear of it is, for one thing, you're just really, think of it as reading sentences. They're just breaking the sentences in different places. So if you can look at it and not think about the end of the line, but just look for the sentence and just kind of read the sentence as you go through. And then always, even someone like me who reads a ton of poetry, I don't really totally get a poem until I've read it a couple of times. So just something about the way a poem is on the page, I feel like, means that you have to spend a little more time with it, because there's more going on than just the sentences. There's also this sort of music. The words are being written in sort of a musical way. It might not be exactly the normal way that your brain wraps its head around words. So you read it once to get the feel of it. You go back and you read it again and maybe again, and all of a sudden you'll see, oh, wait, I do get this. I do get this. I do get this. And a poetry reading is even better. If you're a little bit afraid of poetry, go to a poetry reading where you can hear the poet read her own words in her own voice, and they can read it in a way where they're almost just talking to you. I mean, you can hear their sentences. That's what you're going to hear is the different sentences, and the music will come out. And I think people are surprised when they're not used to going to poetry readings that they sit there and they do get it, and they can get in there so moved. And it's almost like going to a concert. You go to a concert and you hear a singer sing their songs, and that's not exactly the way we talk. That's not like a work of fiction, but you get the songs, right? You can listen and hear it and feel that music in your heart and feel the beat, and that's kind of what a poetry reading is. It's more like a concert, I think, than anything else.
Poet and editor Rhett Eisman-Trull. Her collection, The Real Warnings, was the winner of the 2010 Brockman Campbell Award from the NC Poetry Society and the 2010 Oscar Arnold Young Award from the NC Poetry Council. Rhett will be reading this Sunday, May 3rd at Scuppernong Books at 3 p.m. She'll be joined by two other poets, Gary Dopp and Jennifer Whitaker. Both Dopp and Whitaker have been featured in Cavewall. Issue 13 of Cavewall is now available. For more information on Rhett, the journal, and the reading, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. On Saturday, May 2nd, the Spirituality and Healing Council will host a half-day literary festival on the Moses Cone campus. Writing to Heal, a poetry and literary festival, will highlight the creative intersection between poetry and medicine through readings and workshops by five North Carolina poets and artists. Featured individuals include Michael Gaspany, Gray Brown, and Peg Janoux, Terry Kirby Erickson, Mark Smith Soto, and Jacinta V. White. Poet and festival coordinator Steve Cushman and poet Terry Kirby Erickson stopped by WFDD. They each shared their work and how poetry has provided an expressive outlet for processing some of the most difficult emotions. We begin with a poem by Terry.
Sponge bath. Draped in towels, my grandmother sits in a hardback chair, a white bowl of soapy water on the floor. She lifts her frail arm, then rests it gratefully in her daughter's palm. Gliding a wet washcloth, my mother's hand becomes a cloud, and every bruise a rain-drenched flower.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm guessing, you know, that was something you witnessed.
Something similar. My grandmother lived to be 95 years old.
Wow.
And my mother, who is a walking hug and who takes care of everyone, she just can't help herself. If you walk into her house, you will be enveloped by my mother. And so she did a lot of caretaking for my grandmother when she was ill. She had osteoporosis, and in the end, she had pneumonia, which I think is something that a lot of elderly people pass away from. It's a beautiful thing, the caretaking experience. If you take away the exhaustion and terror, it can be, you know, a lovely time of reconnection and a way for a daughter and a mother to bond in a different way. You know, like, I took care of you and now you're taking care of me. And for both of you to allow that to happen and to be okay with, you know, that love shifting a little bit and the roles shifting.
Mm-hmm. In that moment, are you aware of the beauty of it, or does it take sometimes translating it into words for you to kind of capture it in one piece and look back on it and think, oh, there is beauty in this. There's the beauty.
I think so, and I think it's necessary for me personally. I don't know about other writers, but sometimes I have to have a little time pass between an emotional experience in order to process it and find words for it, because sometimes there just aren't any words. You just are almost blank with absorption. You know what I mean? You are just taking the whole scene in. You're feeling what you feel about it. You don't necessarily have a vocabulary for it. And then you go back in the silence of your office or wherever you are and go back in memory to that moment. And, you know, the words come, hopefully, or not. You know, it just depends. Sometimes you have to wait even longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that that's part of what poetry making is too, as well, is that that idea of taking that scene and making it into art somehow, some, you know, sort of contextualizing it that you can't do at the time that it's happening. And so it does seem that you do need that time of reflection.
Well, also, it's something in what you said, the idea of going back to a quiet office or a quiet home space, mm-hmm. that's a privilege. And I guess now maybe I want to ask you, Steve, sometimes that helps reflection, but sometimes patients, if they're in the hospital for an extended period of time, they have to make their art right where they are, with mm-hmm. the noise of the machines around them, with the round-the-clock care, the lights, that kind of environment. So you feel like poetry can be made in that setting as well?
I think that it can. I mean, I think that you can do it by a variety of ways, such as, again, you know, you can dim the lights, you can put on soft music, you can sort of set that tone and sort of put all those medical pieces of the equipment as far in the background as you can and try to make the patient comfortable. You'd want to start with, you know, having them read poems, getting in that mood, sort of taking them into that place that they could create from.
Empathy. Close as two women crooning into the same microphone, they sing their sorrows to one another in a grocery store parking lot, keys dangling from their hands, cars waiting still and silent as good dogs beside them. People pass by unnoticed. The sky grows dark. On and on they stand, rooted to the pavement, sharing sadness like a loaf of warm bread. Eyes luminous as pearls, formed by her friend's suffering. Perhaps the stars will wish on them tonight. For even as they part, briefly touching, their glow is brighter, the ground lit beneath their feet as they walk away, each wearing the other woman's shoes.
The lines that really stood out to me, or the one line actually, is sharing sadness like a loaf of warm bread. Mm-hmm. The idea of, you know, the act of sharing, even if it is something that is painful or tragic or includes grief, that can be nurturing and can be helpful. Mm-hmm. What do you feel about what community in sadness does?
Well, for that particular moment, just to use that as an example, this came from a real thing that happened in my life where a dear friend of mine was diagnosed with a serious illness. And we had been out to dinner with some other folks, and they were waiting on us to go to someone's house. And she and I just started talking about what was happening in her life and talking about creating a space. Everything disappeared. The parking lot, the other people, I don't know how long we made them wait, you know, I have no idea. But we connected in that moment in ways that we'd never had, and we're so much closer as a result of that moment than we were prior to it. It was just magical. I don't even know how to describe it. You know, the best I could do was the poem, you know, where I felt like she was truly my sister, that we shared one body, that we were sharing this moment in such a deep way, and I felt her sorrow and fear and sadness, and I felt the same for her, and also I was experiencing emotions that I had felt in illnesses of my own that were serious in my life. And I think you can move that out, you know what I mean? To encompass more people.
And Steve, I wonder if you could tell me, is this the first festival of this kind? What inspired you to make this happen?
So this is the first festival that we've had at Cone Health. It came out of a council called the Spirituality and Healing Council, which I'm in and about a dozen folks are in. And what that council does is it looks for, alternate ways to heal, different ways to heal within the hospital. Writing is certainly one of them, but we also look at massage therapy, dance therapy, aromatherapy, Reiki, healing touch, all of these different alternate methods of healing. And so through that, I taught two expressive writing courses were for the caregivers, more for the caregivers than patients at this point. And it was really interesting. The classes went well. People wrote about a lot of experiences. Some of it they wrote about their hospital experience, but some of it they just wrote about their lives. And from that, we were looking to sort of take it to the next step and just sort of bring this to a bigger arena. One of the big ideas with this festival, I think, is just to get that idea out there, the idea of poetry and medicine, that it is a possible creative outlet. And so that was sort of the driving force.
Wonderful. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about your own personal career path and how it has dovetailed with your writing and your poetry specifically, and then maybe we can hear a few of your pieces.
Sure. 1993, about 22 years or so ago, I became an x-ray tech. And a couple years after that, I started writing. I wasn't writing about medical situations or anything. I've done both of them together for the last 20 plus years. And the funny thing is for about the first 15 or so years of that, I mostly wrote fiction. And when I wrote fiction, I didn't really write about my medical experiences for some reason. I don't really know what it was. But when I started writing poetry 3 or 4 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, the medical experiences seemed more appropriate for some reason. Not exactly sure why, but I still work at the hospital and I still write, and they sort of are two lives side by side that I live.
Do you have any theories on why your experiences in the medical realm and the medical field do lend themselves well to poetry in that particular form or medium?
Well, one of the things, that I think is poetry's strength, or at least the poetry that I like, is sort of the way that poetry is able to, sort of crystallize, a moment and sort of take that moment and make it something bigger. And I find that, at least my experience has been that while writing poetry, I've been able to do that in smaller pieces as opposed to, stories and novels and that type of thing. And so as I sit down each morning to write, I sort of just see whatever images come to me and I write from them. And if those images are things that I've seen in the hospital last week or 5 years ago, they seem to lend themselves to poetry.
I want you to read some of your work, but I also would like you to speak to the need for caregivers to express some of the things that they're going through. I think sometimes perhaps individuals might forget that there might be a need for a lot of healing on their end as well. There can be a lot of pain and grief that's experienced as a caregiver. How can poetry help those individuals as well as the patient?
Right. So I think one of the ways that the poetry can help the caregivers is that, because a lot of poetry is really about making sense of the world. And so for the caregiver, as they're writing about their experiences, it does give them an opportunity to put those things down on paper. And oftentimes, putting things on paper gives it a different value than just sort of swimming around in your head. The other piece of that is the fact that, if you do read poetry by other caregivers, you'll see a shared experience. And you'll see that you're not the only person who's sort of going through these things. And so I think that also is something that can be helpful for caregivers as well. This is a poem titled Boring. After x-raying the dying boy, I called home and spoke to my 7-year-old son, a boy taller and funnier than I would have ever imagined. He told me he was bored, there was nothing on TV and too much homework to do. I wanted to tell him to forget about homework and that TV, to go outside and smell the air, roll around in the grass, but I didn't. Instead, I drove home on my dinner break and helped him with his math homework. The chance to hold him, to smell his hair, feel his weight against me. I kissed him on the forehead, then drove blurry-eyed back to the hospital, where nothing is ever as boring or perfect as what we leave behind.
How old is your son now?
He is 12 now.
I was going to ask if he had read that poem yet, but I'm guessing
he has not. He has not read that one.
Is poetry part of the way you balance your work and personal life? Is it part of a way you process what happens at work and then either take with you what you're able to or leave what you need to leave at work?
the two subjects that I write about, and certainly not on purpose, I don't sit down and say this is what I'm going to write about. The two subjects that I seem to go to are my hospital experience and being a father. And so this particular poem, I think, you know, sort of melds those two worlds, for me at least, in the way that they touch each other and bounce and, you know, bounce back and forth. For me, personally, without writing, writing's, again, something I've done for over 20 years now. So, you know, it's to me, it's like breathing. You know, I mean, I'm always writing. I'm always doing something.
Some of the individuals who are going to be attending this festival, perhaps they haven't written anything before. What is your advice to them to get started? How do you, back to the topic we were talking about earlier, how do you create a safe space for them to begin expressing themselves?
You're usually tapping a vein, I have found, mm-hmm. you know, because people want to tell their stories and they just need permission to do so or some kind of catalyst that allows them to reach down and bring out those emotions. And that kind of goes in with what I'm teaching, which is anxiety, PTSD, and poetry. You know, I don't know if PTSD is a permanent condition, but I certainly had it in my 20s and still have some remnants of it today. So poetry has helped me enormously to find a centering, calming place. And it's kind of a zen experience. You just sit there and the whole world disappears. It's been wonderful for me. And anxiety is something that I think is prevalent in people more than we could ever imagine. So many people have it and they don't talk about it. Sometimes it's just, you know, I'm anxious before I do this or when I do that. And then sometimes it's constant anxiety. For me, I wake up every day afraid, every single day of my life. And that's something that I have to overcome as I get up and go through my day, because I had a series of traumatic events and losses happen to me at a young age. So, you know, I tend to have a little bit of catastrophic thinking. And poetry centers me. It helps me to realize that, you know, not everything is going to end in some sort of Shakespearean tragedy. I want people not to be intimidated. You know, basically, I want people not to be afraid of poetry. Sometimes people have difficult experiences from high school where they've had to dissect a poem like a frog in biology class. And I don't want that to be sort of a fear or some lingering reason why people wouldn't want to experience a poetry and medicine festival. Because poetry is like a heartbeat. It is accessible to everyone. It is for everyone. Anyone can write it. I'm not saying that you're going to win the Pulitzer Prize, but anyone can write a poem. So I hope people will come and they will see what I mean when I say that poetry has saved my life.
Yeah, and we want everybody to come. I mean, we want people that are poets, that are, you know, people that aren't writing poetry, people that have had any care, you know, either caregiver or a patient experience, just to sort of see what's out there and sort of, you know, it's an avenue that may inspire them, you know, to go down. And so really, we just, you know, we want as many people that to come with an open heart and an open mind to experience poetry and medicine.
Poets Terry Kirby Erickson and Steve Cushman. Writing to Heal, a poetry and literary festival, is this Saturday, May 2nd, from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Award-winning North Carolina poets will be reading and leading workshops such as Anxiety, PTSD, and Poetry, Poetry as Pain Relief, The Art of Losing, Poetry, Grief, and Healing, and more. The festival is free and open to CONE staff, patients, and community members. To register, send your name and contact information to poetry@conehealth.com. For more information on the poets and the event itself, visit our website at wfdd.org. And once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend, and we have to take a short break, but stay with us because when we come back, Mary Dalton offers her insight on the documentary The Hunting Ground.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Next up, we'll go behind the scenes with Mary Dalton. She's professor of communication, film studies, and women's, gender, and sexuality studies at Wake Forest University. She'll be talking about the documentary The Hunting Ground, which opens this weekend at Aperture Cinema in downtown Winston-Salem.
The documentary The Hunting Ground has been in the news a lot, so you might have heard about it. It's a really, really intense, provocative film, and it's about sexual assault on college campuses. The writer-director, Kirby Dick, is known for two other films that I like a lot. One is called This Film Is Not Yet Rated from 2006, which explains how the MPAA has a double standard when it comes to deciding what ratings to put on films. I highly recommend it. He also, along with producer Amy Ziering, made the film The Invisible War in 2012, which was nominated for an Oscar. You may have heard about that one, too. It's about sexual assault in the military. The Invisible War helped spark new discussion of sexual assault in the military in Congress, and hopefully it will help people take notice and take action. I'm hoping that this film might spark some action, too, by helping explain how the Department of Education Title IX suit that you may have read about in the papers has come about and explain what types of sex discrimination it seeks to address. For me, as a film, The Hunting Ground works better than The Invisible War because there are lots of observational sequences that break up all of those talking head interviews. Even though those talking head interviews are the compelling piece that draw us in and give us that visceral impact of what victims have experienced.
The first few weeks, I made some of my best friends, but two of us were sexually assaulted before classes had even started.
I went to the dean of students' office, and she said, I just want to make sure that you don't talk to anyone about this.
They protect perpetrators because they have a financial incentive to do so.
So one thing that distinguishes The Hunting Ground is that there's a stronger narrative framing than I've seen in some of his other films. In this case, he follows two UNC Chapel Hill students, the two who filed that original Title IX complaint with the Department of Education, and he follows how UNC has dealt with their case. Andrea Pino and Annie Clark are both really compelling figures in the film, but all of the students who tell their stories are.
The problem with sexual assault on campuses is enormous.
I think it's fair to say that they cover these crimes up.
There's a lot of victim blaming.
He lectured us about how we shouldn't go out in short skirts.
They told me, despite the fact that I had a written admission of guilt, that I presented to them could only prove that he loved me.
There have been some challenges to some of the statistics that are cited in the film. All I can say is that as a college student many years ago myself, and as somebody who has worked with college students for very nearly 30 years, everything I see in the film rings true.
This is a national problem.
I was getting threatened. It was working in their favor to silence me, and I was terrified.
I thought if I told them, they would take action, but the only action they took was against me.
Some people might argue that the film takes off in a few little tangents. I don't think that's a problem for me. The film is dealing with a very, very complex topic, sexual assaults on campus, and it looks at the subject through different spheres of influence that include fraternities and athletics and administrative fears about alienating big donors. And it does this in a way with all of the individual personal stories.
They discourage them from going to the police. If it goes to the police, then it's more likely to end up as a public record.
Universities are protecting a brand.
The campus police cannot contact an athlete.
He won the Heisman Trophy with his DNA rape kit.
Just sit down with the students and ask them, where are the hot spots?
SAE, sexual assault expected.
The second most common type of insurance claim against the fraternity industry is for rape.
Her rapist's name matched the name of two other cases, and he was allowed back on campus.
The message is clear, you're not gonna win.
Headlines continue to come out about the Rolling Stone article and the shoddy reporting on a story that alleged a gang rape at a fraternity at the University of Virginia. And that story has been found to not meet any journalistic standards whatsoever. But I'm hoping that people are not going to let something like that story keep them from seeing this film, because I think this film does stand on its own in terms of giving us these stories. I think it's a film that parents should see, that college students should see, that people who are going to go to college at some point should see, and also that anybody who cares about the community should see. And notice I didn't say that women, because this is a problem for women and for men. It's a problem we all need to be invested in and that we all need to address. We all need to pay attention and take some action.
These students went from sexual assault victims to survivors and now activists.
My name is Carolyn Luby.
My name is Alexa Schwartz.
My name is Ari Mostov.
We've got a lot further to go.
That's Behind the Scenes with Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Wake Forest University, Mary Dalton. The documentary, The Hunting Ground, opens at Aperture Cinema in downtown Winston-Salem this weekend. You'll find links to showtimes at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. Our executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Elena Dolman. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well at Triad Art Speak. And you can keep up with us on Facebook by liking 88.5 WFDD. Send your emails, questions, and comments to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.